on a possible introduction of committee measures. And Patrick, tell us a little bit about this, if you would, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, let me bring up my notes on this here. Members, before you, you'll find LC 3572, which was brought to us by the Association of Oregon Counties. The measure is designed to address a couple issues. And I believe we have Bob Cantine here who might be able to give it a little bit of explanation than I do.
That's fine. Bob, you want to come up, please, you and Dennis? I'm going to ask Bob Cantine and Dennis Mulvihill to go ahead and come on up. Just to give us a little rundown on what the on what this does in committee. What my intention is just introduce this as a committee bill, and then the speaker's office, wherever they send it, they committee consideration. But I think that this is something that we need to at least have a conversation about, and this bill will provide that vehicle. Bob, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties. I was thinking it's ironic that down the hall they're getting ready to meet on what money's going to be available to the state while we're sitting down here meeting on this bill, which is a response to what's happened to the money in the state. So essentially, I guess I could put it real simple to say that the bill is about giving some protection to local governments when we don't backfill the losses of state funds. And the issue there is the exposure that we have if there's a duty in the statute to perform a function, and then there's a withdrawal of the money by the state that normally would fund that, and we start reducing the service, then the question that arises is whether we are open to lawsuit for failure to provide service. Do we have the same discretionary immunity that the state does, or that a county governing board would have in designing their own budget? And so we're sort of caught in that untenable position. As the money is withdrawn, the statutes aren't changed. They're left the same. So how can we deal with that? And essentially what we do is have the state transfer their discretionary immunity to the county as it carries out that service. And in that way, when we can't backfill or don't backfill something where the state has removed funding, then our exposure is more limited. We're in a better position to defend that issue of not providing service or reducing service. We also did in here a couple of other things that are related to it. One is to provide a mechanism here for how do we deal with the different opt-out provisions that are in the law. Right now you have an opt-out provision in community corrections which says if the state doesn't meet a funding requirement, the local government can decide to return that to the state, and right now we're in the middle of that with community corrections. I think there are four that have filed for the state that they can't handle it, and so they're going to file to return it. We have some similar language, but not very clear language in public health and in mental health. I think in public health it's something like we can relinquish the authority. And what does that do, and who pays for it after you relinquish the authority? And we try to clarify that, just have a standard set of provisions across children, families, mental health, public health, and community corrections, because those are the big ones that we perform for the state. Then we do we provide for the agency. We empower the agency, if it's interested, to work with the county and say by contract, okay, this is all the money you got left. This is what we left. We started out with $1 million and now you've got $100,000. Where are we going to put the $100,000? Where's the best use of that money? And we would do that by contract to agree how to get that accomplished. And then finally, it provides that in this case, since we're simply your agent in delivery of the service, that the state would defend us if we are sued for failure to provide the your service to the public when that money is reduced. So those are the four parts of the bill. And I'd be glad to answer questions or Dennis, anything you want.
Dennis is waving us off. He doesn't need to say anything. Are there any questions for I'm ready for a motion, you bet.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'd move that we introduce LC 3572 as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski moves that we introduce LC 3572 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, then it is introduced. And so thank you very much, and we will follow up with this as it moves through the process.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the work session on the committee introduction of committee measures, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 676. I'm going to ask Randy Hildebrand to come forward, if he would, please. And while he's doing that, would you, Patrick, like to tell us what the bill, as we have it before us, does, please?
I'd be glad to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 676. We heard previously on the 8th of May, just last week, in fact, the measure modifies control and regulation of state-owned passenger vehicles and light-duty vehicles. Has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Randy Hildebrand. I work for the Senate Republicans. I know that Representative Brzezinski and I disagreed on this the last time I testified before this committee, but I firmly believe that January's vote denying the tax increase was not a vote against children or a vote against state troopers or a vote against health care workers or a vote against teachers or other hardworking employees. I believe it was a vote for government efficiency. I think the governor and legislative leadership understand that voters will not support a major tax increase until we prove to them that government is running efficiently. That's why we have a Democratic governor and a majority of senators and representatives working hard to make significant changes to PERS. In that very same vein, Senate Bill 676 will save Oregon taxpayers potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars by consolidating the many independently operated agency motor pools under DAS. Representative Brzezinski, while our buddy from Cottage Grove does support consolidation, Senator Corcoran made it abundantly clear to me that he does not support privatization. He feels that state employees have taken enough of a beating on PERS and other issues, and I firmly believe that this bill will not mean any state employee losing their job. The leading national expert in state-operated vehicles, Maximus Inc., in its Oregon Fleet Study, recommends consolidation. Les Rucker, the leading consultant on the study, recommends that all state agencies that do not have statutory authority to own vehicles, such as OLCC, turn over their operation of these cars to DAS, rather, Department of Administrative Services, in no more than 4 years. A lot of the other agencies, such as OLCC, do not even keep track of fleet expenditures, such as fuel usage. Maximus also recommends state agencies should consolidate for other reasons, such as low utilization. Again, agencies such as OLCC, which owns at the time of the report 34 sedans, was underutilizing at least 50% of those cars. They, along with many other agencies, fail this important efficiency test. Many state-owned cars sit idle more than industry standards would dictate. Simply put, agencies have too many cars that aren't being used enough to warrant their ownership. We've already brought savings to taxpayers by eliminating the redundant gas station attendant at the main motor pool here in Salem. That was a $73,000 a year savings. And by reducing the DAS fleet by 33%, over $250,000 in general fund savings alone. We need to be diligent to bring efficiencies to government. The private sector has to do this or it goes broke. The day when government could just raise taxes is gone. It first must become more efficient. Other than PERS and maybe the Oregon Health Plan, I believe this is the next major area for reform. The state owns over 11,000 vehicles that travel over 75 million miles each year. The national expert in this area says Oregon can do better. I'm here to tell you that this is how we get it done with Senate Bill 676. I have supplied the committee with a handout, a two-page handout that lists the underutilized vehicles in Oregon, and you can see that a couple of the smaller agencies, including DEQ and Eastern Oregon University, have 100% underutilization. That means that the few vehicles that they do own are greatly underutilized. They don't rack up enough miles each month to warrant having that many vehicles. As you can see, OLCC, with its 34 vehicles, 17 of those vehicles, or 50% of their fleet, is underutilized. Like I said earlier, simply put, they don't rack up enough miles to warrant their usage. The second page of the handout does list the cost per mile, and as you can see, since some of the agencies don't list various or track various reporting mechanisms such as fuel cost, it's impossible to determine what their true cost per mile really is. So I would urge the committee to support the Dash 1 amendments to 676. It does, through a ratchet down process, starting in July 05, require state agencies that own vehicles that are either 7 years old or older or have 100,000 miles or greater, sell those vehicles and turn over ownership to DAS. With that, I would urge your support and offer myself up for any questions you might have.
Are there questions for Randy on the Dash 1s or anything else? Representative Brzezinski?
Thank you. Randy, I think we all agree that wherever we can get government efficiency, that's a maximum for the taxpayers, and also something we should do. With that in mind, I assume that you would agree that if an agency is able to demonstrate that their use of a independent fleet or their own fleet is more efficient than what DAS could provide, that you would accept that that would be the way that we should go, since it would give the taxpayers a greater return on their tax dollars?
I would agree with that, with only one clarification, that we don't leave it up to the individual agencies to determine that, but either a national expert such as Maximus or maybe even the leading experts in the state, DAS folks.
Okay. If I may?
Go ahead.
Yes. That's really a great segue, because it would seem to me that now, seeing the amendments, and we're just getting them this morning, that one of the things that we may actually want to do to make certain that we don't go down the wrong path too quickly or at all is to make certain that there is that review, such as DAS, going through, working with each of the agencies based on the list that you have, to determine whether there would be what would be most efficient. Would you agree with that?
I would argue that that's already been done in a lengthy report that DAS contracted with Maximus Group. We took over 2 years to study this issue, not only last session, but last interim. Through extensive research, I believe that the numbers are pretty firm at this point, and that we already have that kind of information available to us.
Okay. The only thing that we've received, at least I've received, is what's titled Final Report of the State-Owned Vehicle Efficiency Task Force, November 1, 2002. Is that what you're referring to?
So that was a summary of the list of recommendations of the Maximus Report, and I'd be more than happy to give you all copies of this report. That list that the various state agencies should consolidate.
Okay, that would be great. I feel in the dark as to being able to comment, since you've spent a little bit more time on it than any of us have, as to exactly what the full report reflects. That's all I have at this time.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Representative Kitts.
Randy, I want to make sure that, thank you for bringing this forward. I think any attempt to make government more efficient, as you will hear if you stick around for later testimony, should be the goal of this body. I want to make sure I understand correctly. You're proposing that every state agency sell or transfer back to DAS a state agency-owned vehicle, and then the state agency then rent that vehicle back from DAS?
That's correct. And you should know that this is a pretty limited scope. In other words, we're looking at standard passenger vehicles that are not specially equipped. So, for example, state police, it's my understanding, would not have any vehicles that this bill would apply to. And you're exactly correct that the agencies would relinquish authority or ownership of those vehicles, turn them over to DAS, and they would be rented back from DAS to the agencies, which a lot of the agencies already do. For example, OLCC does contract with DAS for some of their day trip vehicles. DAS does a very good job of operating its state fleet. We've had extensive review of their operations. And while I believe there still are a few efficiencies, for example, the contracting out of the extra vehicles through the peak periods that we're working with DAS, there are a few efficiencies yet to come. But that's exactly what I'm proposing.
May I follow up?
Follow up? I believe it was last week we heard testimony regarding a bill that would, I believe it was DAS, maybe Cindy can refresh my memory, the gentleman's name that was in charge of the whole fleet was here testifying.
Rob Lobo.
Thank you. As to the fact that General Motors or any of the big three, I think he said, that they contract with, would not give us any type of a break by locking down one of the big three, i.e. one vendor for the entire state. Do you think that if we were to consolidate the purchasing power, i.e. so it wasn't an individual agency, you know, let's say OLCC, let's say Department of Transportation, whoever may be trying to buy 1,000 vehicles, for example, but it was DAS who was in charge of the entire state motor fleet and was able to purchase in bulk of 20,000 or 25,000 vehicles, do you think that we could then qualify for some form of a break? If we were to, you know, I'm talking double savings, I guess.
It would be my understanding that we already are realizing those types of savings. I just know a little bit about state contracting enough to be dangerous. It would be my understanding that if DAS has a contract with General Motors, for example, for a bulk purchasing agreement for vehicles, it would be my understanding that other agencies currently could participate in that contract.
Okay.
So I would like to address that issue, though, with clarification of what the savings would, how the savings would come about by through consolidation. Again, it's very important to track the usage of these vehicles. DAS does an excellent job of tracking the usage, not only the fuel costs, the maintenance costs, who's driving these vehicles, and how far and how long. Many of the smaller agencies simply don't have the staff or the resources to track these vehicles appropriately to really identify whether they're being used efficiently. That's where you get most of your savings in this operation, is by the increased reporting requirements and tracking of the vehicles.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Randy, for being here. Your numbers, I'm just curious why they're so obsolete.
I would argue that they are not obsolete, but merely about 6 months out of date. They were the best figures available when the Maximus Group performed their study. Some of these figures were gathered as early as January 01 through the two-year period which this report was taken on. So it's my understanding that the figures were correct at the date of the publishing of the report. And if you'd like to pick out a particular area that you think has a discrepancy, I could address that, I believe.
Representative.
I'm referring to this report that is the year 2000, and I'm wondering why we're getting data 3 years old.
Is that the handout that I handed out to you? That's dated for the 01 biennium. Again, those are the figures that were gathered from the state agencies at the time of the compilation of the report.
The reason I'm asking that question is because when Mr. Lohoff testified before us previously, he reported there were 8,000 vehicles of this category, 37,000 total licensed, 12,000 of the state. But out of the 8,000, that DAS only oversaw 4,000 among 38 agencies, and then we're just accounting for 3,000 and. Maybe this is one reason that people don't vote for a measure. You were referring to that, because it takes us 2 years to do something, to look at something, and in the meantime, we've purchased 1,000 more vehicles just for this category, and this doesn't count for the other 4,000 in this category, plus the other, 30,000 that are licensed in the state. I'm wondering why you don't use those numbers, those total numbers, and define who's responsible for 37,000 vehicles.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the question. I have a two-pronged answer for that. First off, though, that's exactly why I would like to see GAS take control of these vehicles. It's very hard to get a solid figure of exactly how many vehicles are owned by the state. I remember back in 1993, I believe it was, I called and asked the state of Oregon how many cell phones they had. They told me to call Cellular One because they don't keep track of the number of cell phones. This is a similar issue with state cars. I believe that certain agencies, if you ask them on the spot how many vehicles they have, they'd be hard-pressed to give you a solid figure. My two-pointed answer is that this is a moving target from day to day or from month to month or year to year. There is a different number of vehicles, whether they're being disposed of or purchased a new number of vehicles to meet increased demand. And second, the definition of the type of vehicle that we were looking at is pretty broad. We have several different definitions. We have a light-duty vehicle definition. We have sedans. We have station wagons. We have pickups that fit in with that definition. And then we've also carved out non-specially equipped vehicles. So, for example, state trooper vehicles with radios and shotgun holsters would not be included. So that's part of the discrepancy in the number of vehicles. It depends on whose terminology and definition that we're using at that time.
Well, may I just then have one more follow-up?
One more follow-up?
Well, then would it be possible to amend this bill to make us accountable? We tried the same thing in land. We still haven't got that report. We don't know what land we own in the state. We haven't got that. We don't know what the salaries are of the people in the state. We don't know how many people we got. Now we don't know how many cars. So I'm wondering, could we amend this bill to be totally inclusive of the entire fleet? So somewhere in state government, there is one consolidated, you know, declaration of these are the vehicles, here's our replacement policy, and it can show clearly which agency is responsible. I know DAS didn't want to be responsible for ODOT buildings, highway equipment. But would you be willing to allow us to amend the bill to be inclusive so in one place we could know this?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that the way the bill stands would get us a lot closer to what you're looking at. With the consolidation of DAS's fleets underneath DAS, rather, they have a much better grip on the number of vehicles that they own and operate. And if you take these standard passenger vehicles out of the equation, in other words, they're moved over to DAS, and which has a really good handle on it, the other vehicles left in those agencies is not going to be a great number, and I think that we would have a much better handle on the agencies would be able to tell you exactly how many vehicles they own. So I believe that's part of the bill. The mechanism of the bill in consolidation is to accommodate, if you will, some of those other factors. In other words, through consolidation, we'll have a much better idea how many vehicles we have. I don't believe it's necessary to amend the bill to accomplish that. But I would be open to anything that you might suggest.
You mean to amend the amendments?
Correct.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood that correctly.
Mr. Chair, I would like to take an opportunity to thank the many folks that have been involved in this process, from Mike Greenfield and Bill Brawley, that are now at the Department of Education, to Rod Lohoff and Dugan Petty and Cam Burney, and also Cindy Becker and Gary Weeks for being willing to have an open mind on this issue that we've worked on for several years. So I really appreciate their support. We could not have done this without their help.
Okay. Thank you. Other Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify. I had a chance to get through most of the amendment. Randy, just when I look at subsection 2 of section 6, it talks about all agencies are not going to be allowed to own light-duty vehicles with the exceptions that you've mentioned that are specially equipped. And then when you look on page 2 on line 13, it makes reference under subsection 7 that subsection 2 does not apply to the department. For clarification, I'm assuming when they use the word department, they're talking about Department of Administrative Services?
That's, Mr. Chair, Member Prusansky, that's exactly correct.
Okay, so basically what you're trying to do from under sub 2 is require all state agencies to basically sell their fleet, and then it would be under DAS. Is that correct?
That's correct.
If I could follow up.
Follow up, yes.
I guess the only thing that seems to be I'm missing is that I thought the report said that some agencies
that this would be appropriate, as in other agencies it may not be, where this subsection 2 seems like it's a mandate for even those agencies that could be very efficient in the use of their fleet would be required to sell. Is that, that doesn't sound like your intent, though.
The report, as with any study, Mr. Chair, member of the committee, the report, with as with any study, does have slight inconsistencies. For example, the consultant based their cost analysis on an out-of-date contract. They based a large portion of the report on a contract, existing contract with Enterprise, rental car agency, for a handful of vehicles, and they extrapolated that out to several thousand vehicles. So the private sector folks are very adamant that those figures could be adjusted downward and show increased cost savings for agencies. I mention that because a lot of this report is based on those inflated figures, if you will, from the private sector. The issue of some left in and some left out, if you look through the report after I give you a copy, the consultant goes about this in a several-pronged approach. One, he states that state agencies that do not have current statutory authority to own vehicles should consolidate with DAS. For example, Board of Public Safety, Department of Veterans Affairs, Fairview Training Center, Judicial Department, and OLCC. In another part of the report, it mentions OLCC specifically that even though they do not track fuel consumption, which would lead me to believe it's very hard to get at an actual mileage cost, that they potentially could operate on their own. Okay. But I would argue that with no statutory authority and with no tracking of fuel costs, that is a serious concern of mine in the operation of their vehicles. And they are obviously highly underutilizing those vehicles. And that was a major point with the consultant in looking at DAS's own operation, was the utilization of vehicles has been a problem, and DAS is making corrective action right now. They're contracting out 33% of their fleet to the private sector, actually.
Okay. So, the last, I guess, is that it comes back to, I think, what we both agreed to and all of us have agreed to. If we want the greatest efficiency, maximize it the best we can, and if an agency does, in fact, demonstrate that their operation of a fleet of vehicles is more efficient than going through DAS, we would all be in agreement that should be what occurs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, if a national consultant or the experts at DAS come to that conclusion, I would firmly support it.
Great. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kitts, you have another question?
I got a question and a follow-up, if I may. Does DAS support this move?
In talking with Cindy Becker.
Let me just interject here. I'm going to ask Cindy and Dugan Patty and Rod to come up after Randy's done.
Okay, I'll save that question for them. Do you know if this would require DAS to employ more FTEs to implement this? If DAS were to take control of the state fleet, would it require more FTEs?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, obviously that's a question better answered by DAS. I would assume that the way this is written doesn't take effect until July of 2005, and it's a very limited approach. In other words, the vehicles have to be of great age and mileage. Not a lot of vehicles will actually come under the effect of this law. It would be my understanding that if there is a need increased personnel, that they could either utilize existing personnel from other state agencies that this might be affecting. In other words, if ODOT or another large state agency was relinquishing control of a large number of vehicles, the person that was dealing with those vehicles could be transferred to DAS. I don't believe it would mean a large increase need for state employees at DAS.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Maybe
Patrick, thank you. Maybe Patrick can answer my question. There is no fiscal on this, and I would assume that if it were required to an FTE, I don't think we could have one or two FTEs. I don't think we can have one FTE under 50,000, so I think it would have a fiscal impact. Is it offset because DAS would increase the FTEs and those that would agencies be losing control reduce FTEs, so it's a wash?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, to answer your question, I believe the staff minister summary indicates that the bill as in its current form, does not have a fiscal impact. Legislative Fiscal Office has not analyzed the bill with the Dash 1 amendment, so I couldn't speak to whether or not it would create a fiscal impact.
We'll probably get that information when gas comes up.
Yeah, yeah. I think that would be most appropriate to ask him.
Okay.
Okay. Randy, right before we came in, I was handed a chart done by OLCC, and it shows that if OLCC were to maintain cost of their own vehicles, that they would have an expenditure of about a shade under $300,000, but that if they were to go to a rental utilizing the private sector, the cost would balloon to $1.5 million, and that if they go to DAS, running the show, that their cost would be about $640,000. Which actually is showing, and that may have led to Representative Brzezanski's questions. Any comments about that? Have you had a chance to look at that?
I would like to meet with the folks that compiled this information and go over their numbers to make sure that they're including all costs. For example, fuel costs are not being tracked to OLCC, so I would argue that it would be very difficult to come up with a solid number like this if you don't know how much fuel you're using. We do have estimates on cost per mile of the different state agencies, which I've supplied to you, and it runs from anywhere from a dollar a mile to 11 cents per mile. And I'm not an expert in mathematics, but if you run the figures, I believe there is some discrepancies in those numbers.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
Randy, in the research, and I've put so much time into this, did you get what the cost per gallon of gas is when it's purchased or provided by DAS versus any of the other agencies?
DAS, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did look at some of those figures. It's an interesting topic. DAS actually receives bulk fuel, surplus fuel, rather, sometimes from the federal government, either in the form of crude oil, which they turn around and exchange for refined fuel. Fuel costs for Department of Administrative Services are at market price or lower. So I believe that DAS would have the best available price for fuel.
Okay. Well, we'll ask them. I just didn't know from the study if you, how detailed you were able, because it seems to me that no matter where the vehicle is coming from, the amount of fuel is going to be required is going to be the same or potentially maybe greater by needing to get the car from DAS and then go to the assignment as compared to taking out of the lot. And I'm just curious as to what the actual cost of the gasoline, because the consumption should be about the same.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm glad you asked that question, because I would assume that if OLCC has 34 vehicles, those are dispersed throughout the state, either in the Portland area or other areas where they're headquartered. And I would assume that they use a commercial fueling card. In other words, they fuel up at Pacific Pride or even Texaco or Shell. If they were to contract with DAS, a majority of those vehicles would be day trip vehicles, would be my understanding. Those vehicles would be fueled at the Portland, Salem, or Springfield lots using DAS fuel at a much lower cost.
Okay. Thank you. Randy, thank you.
Thank you.
Cindy, would you and Dugan and Rod like to come up and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Share with us your perspectives.
For the record, I'm Cindy Becker, Assistant Director of the Department of Administrative Services, and with me are Dugan Petty and Rod Lohoff. Dugan is the Deputy for Procurement Fleet Surplus Services. Yeah, okay. And Rod is the Manager of the Fleet. So you want to know what we think about this?
Well, we'd like to, we would like to get your input as far as the Dash 1s are concerned. Mr. Lohoff was here on the last time we had this bill up, I think last Thursday, and indicated that the bill, the way it is already, that DAS was in support. And I think that would also indicate, you know, potentially the support of the governor with the bill as is, but with the Dash 1 amendments, I'd like to just, you know, get your get your input on that, and I know that Randy's been working with DAS and trying to come up with a way of being able to approach this, and so.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have been working with Randy, and the concept of consolidation is one that we support. We want to make sure that we do it smart, though. I think that, and that goes to Representative Brzezanski's statements about the amendments. I'm not into just doing things just because across the board, and would support the fact that an agency can show us, and I also like the fact that it's got to be, or the recommendation that it has to be verified. That we want to make sure when an agency is putting its costs together that they're fully loaded. Sometimes agencies' costs don't, and we're not always comparing apples to apples. And as long as the costs are fully loaded, we can verify that. And if when the dust settles, the agency can do it cheaper, then clearly there's no reason for us to want to consolidate that. But we want to make sure that that verification happens. The concept of consolidating is one that we think makes sense from an administrative perspective. A lot of this information that's in the Dash Ones came from a former Senate bill where we had done a fiscal impact. The fiscal impact really is around the ability to replace the cars as opposed to staff. We did not ask for any additional staff, and the way this amendment currently is formatted, it would actually make that even less of an issue because it is staged out, whereas its predecessor bill was not. And so we will not be adding any of those high-paid staff that Representative Kitts thinks are populating DAS. We have not asked for any such positions. We would only need, if you go ahead with this bill, we do need to get the approval to be able to sell COPs to replace these vehicles and, again, to increase our limitation to be able to do that. But we're not asking for any positions. But, again, we do support the concept of consolidation as outlined in this bill. We also support the recommendation from Representative Brzezanski that and this should be done on an individual agency basis, so we can verify whether or not it's cost efficient to do that.
Okay. Representative Brzezanski.
Thank you. And I can say what I wanted to do is when I look at the section I brought up to Randy, section 6, 2, or subsection 2 starts on page 11, lines 11 through 15. It would seem that if we were going to move an amendment to the bill, that it should actually have language that clarifies that not every state agency is going to be required to sell their fleet, but some type of condition that they go through this analysis that's going to be with fully loaded cost and having the same standards. And then DAS would be, in this case, has this, let's say, the primary agency make a determination as to whether or not that incorporation or the consolidation should occur. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezanski, that's exactly what we're saying. And I think it's really important to point out that we are not kind of like Pac-Man trying to just gobble things up if they don't make good sense. And so, to the extent that we're looking at it from a statewide perspective, mm-hmm. Those things that administratively make the, get us to the cost efficiencies, we want to consolidate them. But I think what you're saying makes sense for the state as a whole, if somebody can prove. And I think DAS needs to be the final arbiter of that. Then we can either go ahead with the consolidation or not. And Randy and I've talked about this as well, and we're fine.
Okay.
Go ahead and follow up.
Regarding the fuel costs, that's something that everyone has raised some concerns with, and, of course, not having that tracked, it's really hard to understand exactly what that impact is. And can you tell us as to what DAS does in the sense of how much it costs, how you're purchasing a fuel, and what your understanding of how other agencies, what they're using, and what the potential difference in cost may be on a given day, not necessarily on a given day, but just in general terms.
Representative Brzezanski, I'm going to turn this over to people who really know because I don't touch gas.
So. Gotcha.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rod Lohoff, and I manage the fleet for the Department of Administrative Services. Purchase of fuel varies from agency to agency. For instance, here in Salem, the department operates a full-blown fuel facility that all state agencies use that are located here in Salem, and those agencies that come to Salem are use that We also have a state contract with a card lock company, Metro Fueling, which is Pacific Pride, that agencies use at their discretion. And then we have a national fleet fuel card furnished by Voyager, which provides fuel at all retail, most retail sites, most major brands. We feel that you have to have a combination, because of the state. So agencies, for instance, ODOT and forestry and those agencies that are right in the, that have a lot of vehicles in this vicinity, use the DAS fueling facility very heavily. Agencies in the Portland metropolitan area probably don't use our facility very often because it's on Swan Island. It's not very convenient to a lot of them. So they buy most of their fuel at retail and some at card lock. What percentages, I couldn't tell you right now.
Here, if I can follow up on that.
Follow up.
Is there any requirements or standards that are set as to the choice of fuel that they're supposed to, or what process they're supposed to make? I understand if you're coming into Salem and you're close enough to the DAS fueling facility, I would assume everyone understands that's where they should be going, assuming that that's going to be the cheapest because it's in bulk purchase. With, I would think the second would be the Pacific Pride or whoever has the card lock, and I understand those are cheaper than if you went retail. Is there some type of hierarchy that's required for the various agencies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, we do encourage those decisions. We can't be in every car to do that, but we do encourage those decisions.
Okay.
Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Cindy or Rod, what is the fully loaded price? What does that mean? Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, when I'm talking about the fully loaded cost, it's not just the cost of the car and an individual who directly works around the motor pools, but there's overhead involved, there's space, there's lots of other things that are involved with the running of a motor pool that is more than just the car and the individual that manages that. And sometimes when agencies give us their pricing, they don't include all of the indirect costs. And so if you're going to do apples and apples, when we ask for fully loaded costs, our costs are fully loaded. We want to make sure that the agencies, that they are, in fact, counting all the dollars associated with it.
She doesn't mean that the vehicle is fully loaded.
Oh, that means it's got six people in it?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I'm talking about the cost to run a motor pool that they're
I'm
fully
just
loaded.
I'm kidding. I understand this very well. Okay. Vehicles, I do understand. But I want to know what your wrap is. I mean, in business, we call that a wrap.
Oh.
So what is your wrap number?
Mr. Chair,
if I report mine buying fuel at $1.20 a gallon, what do you add to it? 20%, 27, 57, 87?
No. We don't add.
What do you add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson.
What's your burden?
We only increase the price 10 cents a gallon here in Salem and in Portland.
Excuse me?
10 cents a gallon here in Salem and Portland.
You
we don't
add that.
To those agencies that use our fueling site.
You any add that to what?
To our fuel cost, which is based on OPIS plus a slight delivery charge.
And what is it? I just want to know.
It varies. It's going to vary on a day-to-day basis.
I know. Just give me a number.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm trying to remember the last report I get. I think that our unleaded fuel was about $1.27 last month.
Okay, $1.27 plus
the 10 cents
to
an agent.
To an agent.
Okay, I got it. Representative Kitts?
This sheet here that was passed out, have you guys seen this? Okay, the OLCC.
This is the OLCC sheet. Did you get a chance to get
John, maybe you could give them a copy if you don't mind.
Where did we get this, Chief?
OLCC. Just back down.
You didn't get one.
Those costs that are associated there, I'll run you down.
We haven't got one. I don't know what it's paid for.
John, can you provide that with the to the assistant, please?
I apologize. I thought he already had.
I think he just was catching us as we were coming in.
as compared to handing it? Because he's actually going to be available to answer some questions.
Mm-hmm. He's from OLCC.
I'll continue.
Go ahead.
These costs that are incurred, I understand the theory of that you folks get gas at the DAS fueling station. If not, you go to a retail pump. Do you just simply submit the receipt back for reimbursement at that point? Or how is that taken care of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, if it's purchased at a retail site, whether it's a card lock or whether it's a commercial site using the Voyager credit card, we get electronic transfer of all that activity on a regular basis. For instance, we get Voyager transfers twice a month, and we can, if we have some suspicions about some activity that we are aware of, we can go in and get it within 2 or 3 days of the actual transaction.
Okay, so you really, so it's just a card then, that you just don't even deal with cash or reimbursement. Okay, what percentage would you say of all fuel that these folks use, what percentage would you say use the DAS pump, and what percentage would you say you go elsewhere and simply pay retail?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, for the DAS vehicles, about 10% is used inside and off of gas facilities, and the rest of it comes from card lock and from retail sites.
Is there a way to break out the difference between card lock and retail sites as well? So three categories?
Yes.
Would it be possible? I'm not asking you to know those numbers offhand, but would it be possible to provide those for the committee?
Yes.
Thank you. Not would it be possible, but could you? I'm a freshman, but I'm learning.
The question was, would you provide it to
would them? You?
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would is Mr. Stovall going to be coming up? I didn't see him sign up to testify. Is he signed up to come up?
No, actually, he's here to answer any questions, but if you'd like to have him talk about the comparison, we can certainly do that.
I would, if possible.
All right. Mr. Stubenville, you want to come up? And I think we're all done with DAS, folks.
And also, I know that
well,
someone...
Could I just ask him one question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Mohawk, would you take over this 37,000 pieces of equipment and be accountable in one place for the state?
Mr. Chair,
inventory and handle the leases back to various agencies. Is that a possibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, in a nutshell, yes, we could do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. John, you want to go ahead and come up? And Lisa, I know you're back there also. Why don't you come up as well? Because we need to move this thing along. We need to move this along. And Representative Kitts had a specific question he wanted to ask you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. My name is John Stubenball. I'm the Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Representative Kitts.
John, these figures that you have provided for the committee, the bottom line, the total cost figure there, what have you included in that number? And what would be more specific, is that gas, insurance, maintenance, the payment on the car, the storage? What are you using to derive at those numbers?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, all of the above, except I believe the cost for gasoline would not be included on the list you see before you.
Follow up. Look, with the numbers that you have provided for us at 62, I've actually run the numbers here. What you're saying, the cost to OLCC per car would be $199 a month for the biennium. If you were to rent that same car at the private sector, it would be $1,062 a month, according to your numbers. Or a DAS leased option would be $431. I would like to see, and I appreciate the work that you've gone through, but I would echo the sentiments of Mr. Hildebrand. I would like to see how you got these numbers. I think they're outrageous. And I mean, this is simply a spreadsheet. I would like to see more data at 62 cars. And you can see my concern at $1,062 is the alleged for private. And I would also like to see how OLCC can pull that off for $199 a month and maybe what kinds of cars. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any... Representative Krasinski?
Nothing else for John. I think he's got the stuff, and he's given us the stuff. I know that
the university systems had a comment that they wanted to put on the record or two.
Lisa?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. I am seeing the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments this morning, and they closely resemble and mirror the Senate Bill 726, which we have been kind of responding to over the last few months. Our concern within the university system, Mr. Chair, is that we've gone through a lot of this work through the consultants and through DAS and with Mr. Hildebrand. And from what we are seeing with our fiscal impact statement, we're not, our estimates are indicating that we would actually end up spending more money by selling our vehicles and then renting, whether it's on a monthly rental, and in the case of maybe at Eastern Oregon University, or through a day tripper situation. And for example, at Southern Oregon University, I guess kind of a couple of the universities stand out in my mind. Southern Oregon University, for example, they indicate that by renting a vehicle, they would actually spend, I apologize, I'm shuffling too many papers here. Now I've gone and embarrassed myself. Let me just switch to Portland State since it's right here in front of me. A 1998 15-passenger van at Portland State University. Its estimated value of $20,000 currently. It's used for outdoor programs for students taking trips. It's averaged used on an average of 126 days a year. The average trip miles for those is 350 miles, traveling over to the coast or traveling up to the mountains. At DAS rates, if we were to go rent those on a daily basis at $22 a day, 22 cents per mile, the estimated cost to the student organizations that use those vans would be, for rental alone, nearly $3,000 for the year, and the mileage alone, nearly $10,000 for the year. So we're looking at close to $12,500 a year for rental, upwards of $25,000 for the biennium. Our fiscal impact statement that we presented to Legislative Fiscal Office on Senate Bill 726, which I indicated resembles closely the bill, is in for the 2003-2005 biennium effect on our expenditures. And this, and I talked to our budget office last night, how did they prepare these numbers? Because I was curious myself. This is based merely on rental of the vehicles. And our fiscal impacts estimates are anywhere from $430,000 to $527,000 for the biennium of 2003-2005. So as we're just not convinced, Mr. Chair, that this actually is going to save the university system any money. We're as interested as anybody else in being efficient, and we believe that if it were more efficient to sell our vehicles and rent from DAS, by golly, we would do that. So okay. We'd just like to see a little more discussion about it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, might I very briefly, there's been much discussion about the Maximus report, which was done looking at this issue. And obviously, I'm not here today to discuss the macro issue of consolidation of vehicles statewide. I'm here today to represent the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I would encourage the committee to look at the Maximus report, which has been done, which specifically states that OLC, the report itself recommends that OLCC be allowed to continue to manage its own fleet as it's done today. So I would encourage the committee to take a look at that report agency by agency, has been much of the discussion before today.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
Thank you. Lisa? Is it true that the university system has hundreds of cars that are not reported that are received from other means than from state government? Hundreds.
Mr. Chair, Madam Senator, I'm not sure I understand when you say acquired from other sources. Using other funds?
Are outside donors are that are given to a coach to use for whatever or any other. Is that not true?
I Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not certain that I can answer that question. I would imagine that if a vehicle has not been purchased through general fund dollars, it is most likely purchased through foundation money that is given to the university foundation by donors. That would be, that vehicle would then be owned by the foundation and not by the state.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Follow up.
Would it be possible to ask you to furnish us with that information?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Anything's possible, Representative?
Yes.
Okay. Probability is a question.
Oh,
no, I'm
okay.
Just kidding. I'm just kidding. Lisa is very good at getting information out to us, so that'll be fine. Okay, thank you very much. With that, the chair is going to move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 676. The reason why I want to make this motion to move the -1 amendments into the bill is simply to we've had a very lively and I think very good discussion about this morning, and I think that we need to move this bill along. I think that we should put the -1s into consideration. Just to let the committee know what my intentions are, is that, and I'm going to have a roll call on the -1s, but if the amendments fail, I'm going to still move the bill as is to the floor. So, but I want you to vote however you feel like you should vote on the -1 amendment. So, any further discussion on the -1 amendments? Call the roll, please. Mara?
Representative Abbasi?
No.
Representative Kitt?
Aye.
Representative Mabry?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Kurbanski?
No.
Representative Warren.
Excused.
Chair Frommel.
Aye. The -1s are have been moved into the bill. Did I count that right?
Yes, you did.
Yes, Mr. Chair, 4-2.
Okay. Thank you. With that, Chair will move. Who said, Mr. Chair? Representative Przanski.
I want to make a statement. I mean, good senators here, and Randy's here. The reason I voted no is because I think subsection 2 of section 6 is not in the proper text, because it basically says that every state agency is going to have to sell and get rid of their fleet. And what we've heard from the testimony is that some of these agencies are actually more efficient in maintaining their own fleet than having them be required to rent from DAS. And it would have seemed that I would have been much more comfortable voting for the -1s if we would have had that amendment to allow DAS, as they've testified, to run the efficiency checks and to determine which agencies were, in fact, being able to provide greater maximum use of the tax dollar as compared to ones that aren't. And the way the bill is written now, we're now in a position that we're mandating every state agency to get rid of their light-duty vehicles, and at what is going to be a greater cost to the taxpayers based on the limited testimony we have before us today. So with that said, my explanation regarding how the -1s and why I was not able to support them at that time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mabry.
Representative Kitts has jokingly called me waffle. I need to put syrup on my fanny to keep me down. But I'm going to waffle today, if I may. I struggled with my vote on this. You haven't hammered the question, I don't think. I struggled with my vote, and I agree. I think what we've talked about here, Representative Przanski, that what we've talked about here is doing that work jointly to determine what is the best. So, with your permission, I would like to change my aye to a no vote.
Representative, I have not dropped the gavel yet, Representative, and
Representative, procedurally, I just want to make sure that do I need to get a suspension of the rules for Representative Mabry to change his vote on the dash one amendments from an aye to a nay? It will change the outcome of the vote.
Mr. Chair, your staff has consulted, and we confirm that you have not dropped the gavel on that yet. And procedurally, I can tell you that on the floor, members change their votes regularly before the gavel is dropped. Saw it many times, and I'm operating under the assumption that that holds true. If you would like us to consult with the chief clerk, we can, but I believe that before the gavel is dropped, the member can change their vote without suspending the rules.
I believe that you are correct. So with that, the Representative Mabry has changed his vote from an aye to a nay. The dash one amendments.
Mr.
Chair. Representative Kitts.
I would hope that my good friend from the Dalles understands that I always appreciate his thoughtfulness, and I think he's probably one of the more thoughtful members of this body. And I don't mean when I my joke in any disparaging comments in any way mean disparaging. That being said, Representative Przanski, I believe, brings up some good points, and I think there are points that need to be addressed. And I would be amenable to allow some discussion with the DAS folks to allow them the time to get that information, to allow OLCC to get the relevant information beyond a simple spreadsheet that has no cited sources to the committee, because I think that the bill and the amendment as is have merit. I would like to work out the differences, and I think that we're at a point where we could work out the differences with maybe just a few more days. So I would like to postpone Senate Bill 676 and any discussion of it to a date certain of next Tuesday, giving the proponents of the bill and the opponents of the bill a chance to get together and work out and see if we can come to an agreement because of the merits of the bill. In general, it's a good bill to maybe next Tuesday, if that would be agreeable with the chair to withdraw his motion.
That would be... let's see. I don't have to withdraw the motion.
Well, you haven't gaveled, but I'm right. There's a motion to accept these amendments, and there's been a vote taken.
Right, right.
Mr. Chair.
One second, please.
And if you're going for a date certain, we need to have the date.
Yes.
We can only debate it regarding the time.
Date.
Correct. Correct. Representative, are you making that?
That is a motion.
That is a motion. All right. Representative Kitts has made a motion to postpone Senate Bill 676 to a date certain of next Tuesday, which would be May
20th, I believe.
20th. And it's not a discussable motion. Debatable motion, except for the date or the time. Representative Nelson, you had a
well, Mr.
question.
Chair. Yeah, I almost need to rise to parliamentary procedure, I guess, or a question of parliamentary procedure, because I feel that the information that Representative Przanski gave us was misleading and not the truth.
It's only to the date.
Excuse me.
There's a motion.
Excuse me, but this is the cause of this action from Mr. Kitts, Representative Kitts, because Representative Przanski explained that he thought Section 6 ordered agencies to sell their vehicles. It does not. It gives them a to do or not to do. And so it's based on Representative Mabry changing his vote because of what Przanski said, and Kitts making a motion because of what Przanski said. I think we need to have the law read by LCO, because that is not what the amendment says.
I appreciate your comments, but I'm going to rule you out of order, because the motion that's before us is to move this bill to a date certain of next Tuesday, and it's debatable only as to the time and the date.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
To the date, I would seek input from OLCC and DAS and Mr. Hildebrand and Representative Przanski if that date is adequate?
I will have to tell you it will have to be adequate, quite frankly, Representative, because we are out of time.
That's fine. Then
and
then I will,
we are out of, and when I say out of time, I mean we are out of time right. In terms of the session, and as it is, pushing this to next Tuesday is probably going to cause the Speaker's office to have apoplexy, but we'll deal with that.
Then I will stick with my original motion to a date certain of May 20th.
The motion is to hold postpone Senate bill consider any further consideration of Senate Bill 676 to a date certain of Tuesday, May 20th. Is there any further discussion as to the date of the time? Seeing none, Mara, call the roll, please.
Representative Atkins.
No.
Representative Kitt.
Aye.
Representative
Mabry.
Aye.
Senator Melton.
Aye.
Representative
Wirth.
Excuse.
Chair Cromwell. Aye. The motion to postpone Senate Bill 676 to a date certain of next Tuesday, May 20th, is passed. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 676. Thank you very much, members. I'm going to open a public hearing and, let's see, is it a public hearing? Yeah, public hearing on HJR 55. And Representative Mabry, I would like you to go to the speaker's table, or the witness table, please.
Thanks.
Representative, go ahead whenever you're ready, please.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to this resolution this morning. Actually, the resolution means probably nothing to the state of Oregon. Whoops, we lost our chair. Probably means nothing to the state of Oregon, but it could mean a great deal to my community college, Columbia, Columbia Gorge Community College, and so it therefore bears some discussion and explanation. Explanation is very simple, but it goes back in history a ways. You may or may not recall way back when the Rajneeshis were a part of Oregon, Wasco County, the city of the Dalles, was the first community in the United States to be attacked with bioterrorism. They poisoned the salad bars in the Dalles. Some 1,600 people got sick, some of them very seriously sick. A few almost died. A number were hospitalized. It was a serious thing. Since that time, of course, we've had the other bioterrorism attack back in the East Coast with the anthrax.
Pardon?
It was anthrax. Okay.
Right.
And so now we're the second community. So that's a little bit of background as to what we're leading up to. Fast forward to today's date. Our community college is the center of learning for two different programs. One is a electronics program sponsored jointly by the community college, by the Corps of Engineers, by Bonneville Power, and by Intel. And they train people to deal with the electronics the equipment that's used in emergency services and in the dams and those kind of things. The other program is a program sponsored by the community college for nurses training. And because of cutbacks in state funding, both of those programs have some jeopardy of being closed, the nursing program in particular. As a result of that, our community college applied for a grant when the federal government, Department of Labor, for a grant to partially fund the nurses' training program that we need so vitally in the state of Oregon, and in particular in the Mid-Columbia area. And they missed the first cycle of funding. They've reapplied, and it's there. During one of our trips to Washington, D.C., we met a gentleman by the name of Pat Butler. who is the number one person of the Washington Post and is a personal friend of the president, the golfing buddy of the president, has a lot of access, and he was very intrigued with what we're doing in the Mid-Columbia. And in fact, at his own expense, he bought an airplane ticket and flew to the Dalles and looked our programs over.
Can you buy an airplane ticket to the Dalles?
All right, airplane ticket to Oregon and a rental car to the Dalles. At any rate, he visited our community and went back and said he was going to try to work to help us get this grant request done. He called recently and said, you know, it would strengthen your position on that grant request if you could get the state of Oregon to designate Columbia Gorge Community College as a first responder of bioterrorism, as a first responder training center. That would add more credibility to your grant request with the federal government, and so that's why we're here. We're not trying to do an end run or anything. It's just a matter of this will improve our funding potential. The grant request is for $5 million, and so we're asking a resolution to be made that would do just exactly that: designate Columbia Gorge Community College as a Oregon First Responder Training Center. I do have the bill as presented use the term as Oregon's first responder training program. The question has arisen, well, what if someone else wants to be designated a first responder training program? And I've said, no problem. We're not trying to exclude anyone. So there was a dash one amendment that has been submitted that I have a copy of. I don't know if you have a copy of it or not, but it merely changes, deletes the word Oregon's in terms of Oregon's first responder and inserts the word as an Oregon first responder. So that amendment would be offered. The other thing is, if in fact we're going to meet again next Tuesday, Community College and the Workforce Development Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development people have said, you know, since this doesn't affect us directly, we would just as soon be scratched off of that bill and just have the community college designated as that. So the other amendment I would offer would be the description, which says directs the community college workforce development to da 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 da, substitute that directs that Columbia Gorge Community College be designated as an Oregon First Responder Training Center, and then down on lines 18 and 19 do a similar thing that says the Columbia Gorge Community College shall be designated as an Oregon First Responder Training Center. That's what the bill does. It's very innocuous.
Representative, when you started talking about your conceptual amendment, you lost me. So tell me again where, if you would please, where that is, what line that's on. I've got the dash ones.
Okay.
So we've got that. That's okay. No problem.
I would just, right up above where it says joint resolution in the description, it says directs the Department of Community College and Workforce Development to designate Columbia Gorge Community College. See that line?
Yes.
Okay. We would just, in fact, substitute in there, directs that Columbia Gorge Community College be designated as an Oregon First Responder Training Center. And then the other place would be the last two lines of the bill. There again, that says that Columbia Gorge Community College shall be designated as an Oregon First Responder Training Center.
Okay, and that's part of the dash ones.
Well, the dash ones what I'm suggesting here is we basically delete the part about the Department of Community College and Workforce Development. The dash ones do not
make
that deletion.
Okay, so
it require probably a dash two, which I could get done almost immediately.
Well, we don't have time for. Well, I guess we are going to meet on Tuesday now, aren't we? Pardon me?
Mr. Chair, we did not.
I just realized that, and so Patrick has gone to make copies of the dash ones for everyone. So anyway, tell you what, while we're waiting for Patrick to come back with those, we have Frank Toto here with from the college. And would you like to come forward?
Mr. Chairman, I'm delighted to introduce our community college president, Frank Toto, to the committee. Frank told me this morning that if he had his druthers, he'd just let me do the work, but I'm sure he's glad to be here.
I was trying to sink into the chair back there, I'm sure.
Well, I noticed that, but I thought you drove all this way. We should at least give you the opportunity, if you want to say anything, to go ahead and make a statement.
Well, thank you, sir. I don't have a prepared statement. It's a pleasure to be here representing the community of the Columbia Gorge, community. We have, as a college, worked very, very hard to make the college a part of the community, and the community has worked very hard to be part of the college. And in that regard, if it weren't for the community working so very, very hard in building bridges with Washington, D.C., in the attempts to acquire funding, for lack of a better way to say that, and some of the wonderful opportunities that we have had to build bridges to people in the infrastructure of Washington, D.C., that it's almost the stuff that dreams are made of. Who would have thought that we would have had a one-on-one meeting with Pat Butler, who not only is the chief operating officer of the Washington Post, he is also the president of Newsweek magazine and incredibly wired in the Washington, D.C. area. So when he suggested that it would be very, very useful for the community to obtain a designation, my first reaction was, well, how could we do this? And I just stood back and watched the community partners engage with this, and as a result, I now find myself sitting at the table talking to you. Thank you for the opportunity. You know, it's been a challenging time for all community colleges in Oregon, and I'm here to tell you that there are challenges, but there are also opportunities. And the community of the Columbia Gorge region have taken the challenge on, said Oregon has some fiscal challenges, and they have gone to D.C., and we have an opportunity here, as Representative Mabry stated, of obtaining potentially millions of dollars for our nursing program. And as you know, the Gorge area has four regional hospitals that are currently struggling to keep nursing programs alive. We have a VA center that has a whole wing closed. And plus we have the current aluminum plant closures. And so if you align the displaced workers with the training programs of the college and the opportunities to put them in nursing programs, it's a perfect match. And so that's the basis of the funding that we're going after. So again, Mr. Chair, appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for either Representative Mabry or Dr. Toto? Representative Przanski?
Yeah. Thank you. Representative and President, it's my understanding that the clarification that we're looking for is just to designate the community college as and first responder. It's not to preempt any other community college that may want to have some type of program in the future for being able to do that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, Representative, did you wanted to make a conceptual? We want to adopt the dash ones, correct?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I wanted to adopt the dash ones. Yes, I just learned this morning that the Department of Community Colleges said, you know, I don't know why we need to be involved in this, and if it's just as well, go ahead and delete our names. I don't think they want to fall on their sword over that issue, but my My speculation was, since it appears we're going to be meeting on Wednesday anyway, if we could get that deleted and make that a part of...
I would rather do, as opposed to hold this up, I would rather go ahead and conceptually amend this. I'll tell you what, let's go, since all the questions are finished. Did you have a question, Representative Nelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for being concerned about this, but I want to ask both of you, I'm concerned that this data in this bill is not correct, as being the first in the nation to respond. So I'm going to caution against that data being in here. And I mean, I don't think that matters, and I would be very cautious, though.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I mean, as far as taking that claim, even though I'm pro community colleges, I mean, you won't find a better plan, but...
Well, all I would say is Wasco County and City of the Dalles has been designated as the first victim of bioterrorism in the United States by someone official, and I'm okay with that. But
actually, sir, Tom Ridge verified that 3 weeks ago.
Well, then I think we need to reference.
Well, and that's where it is referenced. The City of the Dalles were the first communities in the nation to suffer and respond to bioterrorism attacks. That's when the Rajneeshis attacked the Dalles and Biggs Junction with Salmonella.
Mr. Chair, then to just let you know why I'm talking about this, there have been many types of bioterrorism. And in Texas, being from a community college, we've had oil. I mean, we've had bioterrorism in those situations, various. We've had various ones in schools and universities, you know, outside of the... So I just, what we call it, under that category, I'm just cautioning you. I just, be careful. Don't want to call enemies.
Okay. Thank you.
Good thing, but not...
Thank you. Okay, with that then, let me close the public hearing. Oh, was there anybody else that wanted to speak on this? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on HGR 55. I'm going to open a work session. Thank you, Dr. Toda, and Representative Mabry is going to come back around, and I'm going to open a work session on HGR 55. Representative Mabry, I would like you to just walk us through the conceptual amendment that you want us to make.
Okay.
Oh, and we have the dash ones to take up also.
If I may then, if we're talking about conceptual amendment, first of all, I would move the dash one amendments.
Okay. Representative Mabry has moved the dash one amendments to HGR 55. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Seeing none, so forth. Dash ones are now in the bill. So you now have those lines read as an Oregon First Responder Training Center,
right,
in both line 13 and line 19.
Right.
The rest of the amendment.
Mr. Chip, pardon me?
You don't have to do that. That's
okay.
Summary. They'll come back and take care of that.
Okay. Then my conceptual amendment would be that we strike on line 18 and 19, strike the words "the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development shall," and insert the word "B," and change the word "designate" to "designated."
That be designated?
That, excuse me, that Columbia Gorge Community College shall be designated.
That Columbia Gorge Community College
shall be designated.
Shall be designated
as an Oregon First Responder Training Center.
As an Oregon First Responder Training Center.
Yes.
Okay. So lines 18 and 19 would actually read that Columbia Gorge Community College shall be designated as an Oregon First Responder Training Center.
That's right.
Okay. Representative Mabry moves that conceptual amendment to HJR 55 as amended by the dash ones. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Mabry?
I would move House Joint Resolution 55 as amended to the floor.
Thank
you. Do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Rip?
Be adopted recommendation.
Be adopted.
Pardon? With the be adopted recommendation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Mabry moves House Bill, HJR 55 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a be as be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Mara, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Excused? Aye. HJR 55, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor be adopted recommendation. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on HJR 55. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3635. Representative Kipps, please come forward to the table. And while he's doing that, you want to tell us what this does, Patrick?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3635 limits the salaries of public officers and employees paid from state funds to the amount of the annual salary of the governor. The bill declares an emergency and takes effect July 1st, 2003.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kipps.
Mr. Chair, and the committee, for the record, my name is Derek Kitts, State Representative, House District 30. House Bill 3635 comes to you as a result of recent investigative reports done by Coin6 News, specifically Gene Greer, uncovering several what I would deem exorbitant salaries in our state budget. And after much deliberation with several colleagues, for the record, Representative Brzezinski was not one of those colleagues, came to the conclusion, you know, after some discussion of why is it that the CEO of the state makes less money than so many other employees of the state. And if we're going to run our state like a business, I think that the CEO should be at the head of the food chain. And in this case, that would be to the tune of $93,600. It's been stated time and time again, how would we get qualified folks here to teach? How would we get qualified docs here to perform medical services? And my contention with that is, with an unemployment rate of 8% leading the country, I firmly believe we would have people circling the wagons or institution of whichever one that was that we're offering the job, be it the state job here at the Capitol, be it at the university. I think we'd have people lined up around the block for $93,000, and highly qualified people for $93,000. I've passed out to you an example which appeared in yesterday's Statesman Journal regarding state employees, the head of the Willamette Education Service District, who threatened to quit because of his menial $116,000 job and the reforms that were done to PERS. After this threat, the board voted, not unanimously, to a compensation package greater than $25,000 a month to retain this individual. And I just firmly believe that in the emails that I've received and the phone calls that I've received from constituents, I will tell you that it's not unanimous about my bill. But I would tell you that it's probably a 10-to-1 ratio of support versus opposition. We would not be the first state in the country to do such things. For example, Minnesota has a compensation limits for local employees. Hawaii also has a compensation cap that they are not able to make more than $85,000 a year. So I believe, with Oregon having an average income for their workers of $31,000 a year that is quite within the realm of feasibility and responsibility to cap state employees at three times or $93,600, that of the average Oregonian. I won't take the committee's time with a bunch of, I think most of you are familiar with the bill. I think you've heard about it, and if there's any questions, I will hurry up and limit my testimony so that those that are here to testify both for it and against it can have their due within the committee time.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Pozanski, Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kitts, you said Montana or Minnesota, I believe, in Hawaii had caps, and you said Hawaii for local at 85, Hawaii for 85,000. And what was Minnesota?
Minnesota, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the current salary of the governor of Minnesota is $120,303. Thus, the compensation for an employee of a political subdivision cannot exceed $114,288, or 95%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I follow up?
Follow up, Representative Nelson.
$85,000 in Hawaii for the governor, or is that for...
The governor in Hawaii makes $94,000, I believe it is. I'm searching for my documentation on it, but I believe it's $94,000. State employees are capped at $85,000. And that's rounding off. It's 94 and some change, and 84 or 85 and some change.
Okay.
And last question.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
The 31,000 you referred to, could you give me your reference again?
I'm sorry, I did not hear your question.
31,000. You just.
The average Oregonian salary of 31,000.
I wondered where you got that information.
The Oregon Blue Book.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Pozanski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a number of questions, if I could. Representative, you made the comment that you want to run government as a business. And isn't it true that businesses do, in fact, have people in the private sector that may actually make more than the CEO based on what they attributed to their company?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pozanski, that may be the case. I would look for examples of that. I don't think that anyone at Microsoft makes more than Bill Gates.
So, if I could follow up.
Follow up, Representative Pozanski.
I notice in the bill it does not apply to personal service contracts. Why is it that you think that individuals who are not actual public employees should be able to make greater money than someone that is a public employee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pozanski, that falls into the category of an excellent question, and I would state that the advice of legislative counsel, it would be too hard to go into ORS 279 and extract those that would fall under public contracting. It would be too broad-reaching, and they were not able to put a definition around it. If you are referencing athletic coaches, as an example, a coach would make, or a coach in this case, makes, you know, $600,000, but it's not general fund money. And that applies also to the president of OHSU, for example, who gets paid $600,000. Only $30,000 of that is general fund, so he would not be affected by my bill at all.
So, if I could follow up.
Follow up, Representative.
If we are desiring to hire the most competent individuals, shouldn't we allow the market rate to bear whatever that salary should be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pozanski, with the state of our current economy, 8% unemployment, the highest in the country, an average salary in Oregon of $31,000, I think it's entirely within the realm of responsibility to put a cap on what folks can make, absolutely. And I don't think that at $93,000 we would in any way inhibit the ability of institutions or state government to attract qualified folks.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Representative, in looking at the summary, it was pointed out to me that your bill actually reflects that the governor's salary currently is $93,600. It's my understanding and belief that it's actually $99,200. And are you saying that we should now allow these employees that you want to cap to be at $99,200 or $93,600?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I'm assuming that was a follow-up. The $93,600, there's been some discrepancy as to whether or not that is the governor's salary currently, or if that's the governor's salary before his 5% reduction. That is something that we need to track down. The governor volunteering to receive less money does not affect what his salary is. And I would not, the legislature has a self-imposed 7%. He's done a 5%. I think it's commendable. I would not lower my threshold to his voluntary actions, rather. So my question to legislative counsel is the governor's salary $93,600 or is it $99,200? So is this number $93,600 after his 5% or so? There's been some discrepancy there with that exact number.
Administrator Patrick can clarify that for us, Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you. When I was looking over ORS 292.313 yesterday, which delineates the salaries for the statewide offices, it indicated that the $93,600 was the governor's salary for the 2001-02 biennium, and that salary was increased for the 2002-03 biennium to $99,200. That's the statutory level, which is what's referenced by House Bill 3635, and I'm not certain. As you said, legislative counsel then went on and later in the bill, and they lowered the ones for the Supreme Court justices to 93. So I'm not certain why they chose the 2001-02 rather than the 2002-03. But that's where the discrepancy is.
Thank you.
Two other things.
Yes, you may.
So, since we know that there are actual salaries that are above and beyond what the governor is currently being paid, and if we do believe that those individuals are the most competent individuals, should we consider raising the governor's salary to allow those individuals to stay within the system, or do you think they should be penalized and paid less as public servants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I wouldn't deem it a penalty to make $93,000 when the average Oregonian makes $31,000. And it's that average Oregonian and the 88% of small business owners out there that make up that are paying those salaries. I don't think that's a penalty. I don't think it's outrageous to ask that. We choose to go into public service. I have 59 colleagues that I think are probably the most capable people in the state that choose to serve for $1,280 a month. With relation to the governor's ability to raise his salary, that's an option. I mean, it's not specified in my bill that is not an amendment that could be drafted or an action that the governor could take. I would say that the latter, the intent of the bill, and I appreciate your thoughtfulness. The intent of the bill is simply to not allow state employees to make more than the governor. We have one of the lowest paid governors in the country, I can say that. And I think you see as an example in Minnesota with my statistic of 120,000. You know, it's 27,000 more than they pay ours. So it's an option.
Mr. Chair, my last comment, I guess, is, and not rolling my eyes, I really think this is a great relating clause.
Thank you, Representative.
Question?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Representative Kitts. Now, does this include superintendents of schools and all teachers and professors? I want to be sure. Does this encompass 275,000 employees or 47,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, as the bill is currently written and as policy, let me back up. As the bill is written, no. Policy of the state does not allow for us to dictate what the six-figure superintendents are making or this $25,000 a month compensation package, most recently the Willamette ESD. However, policy with relation to that can be changed.
But this bill does not include it, Mr. Chair.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, for clarification, my bill cannot include that until the policy. My bill would have to change the policy that does that.
Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one could legitimately argue that with respect to the management of the state and affecting any kind of social policy, the Supreme Court justice, state Supreme Court justice, or a legislator even, might really have more power than the governor would in either of those regards. I'm wondering why, or any state agency head in any given situation, I'm wondering why you choose the governor as the king by which all the other subjects are going to be compared.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, I don't refer in any way, shape, or form to the governor as king. I do think he is the head of our state. I think he is the leader that we follow. I have a meeting this afternoon with the Chief Justice. I'm sure he may have some comments about my bill as well, and in relation to why maybe I did not pick the Chief Justice. My bill, I look at my bill as a block of clay that we are able to mold and come up with something and get the dialogue going. Our state is in a crisis. We are proposing cutting school days. We are proposing cutting teachers. We are proposing a lot of cuts at the lower end of the spectrum with regard to salary. And there has not been one proposal dealing with the top end. And I'm simply attempting to get the dialogue going. And with that, I very much appreciate the thoughtfulness of several of the representatives on the committee, Representative Pruzanski specifically, and Representative Avakian, who I've had a conversation with about this bill at length, and I think they have thoughtful objection to it and concerns to it, but I think that they are very professional in their objections and concerns, so I'd like to thank them.
Okay. Oh, Representative Pruzanski and then Representative Mabry.
I don't yield.
No.
You don't get a choice.
I don't get anybody
asked.
I've sat here thinking about your analysis, and I'm just going to need to throw this back out because I asked you about individuals that are actually not covered by this bill that are doing the professional service contract. So you have an individual who's in the private sector who's under a personal service contract to the state. They're getting paid by taxpayer dollars, so tax government money that, as you said, the taxpayers are paying. What, under your analysis, shouldn't they be willing to take less money and limit the cost that they charge the state as public service or whatever it may be to the level that's limited by this bill?
Representative Pruzanski, again, talking with legislative counsel about specifically ORS 279, public contracting, there is no way to get your arms around how far-reaching that ORS is and to limit that. So the short answer is no. Legislative counsel is available for you to draft amendments if you would like to.
I was really asking for your position on it as compared to what maybe legislative counsel to me. We can write the bill. We can't break a contract. Well, I guess we can. We've already seen that with 2003. But I guess what we can also look at is what could be in the future. So under your philosophy and approach, do you think that individuals who are getting paid with state dollars or local dollars should be limited in how much they get based on the theory that they should not get paid anything greater than the governor?
Representative Pruzanski, I think that it depends. I don't think there's a simple answer. I don't think that's a yes or a no answer. What I do think is that we do need to look at monies that the state is paying employees with taxpayer dollars. Okay. when it comes to ORS 279 and the general contracting and these sorts of things, there are, it's such a vast, broad range of services that are provided. It's not necessarily a specific salary to an individual. It could be a contract to do certain things that include, you know, it's a bidding process. So it's not, it, there's just no way to put your arms around it. And quite frankly, I don't have the list in front of me of everything that would fall under that ORS to see where, in fact, you know, if we're contracting out a specific contract to do a job, what those salaries are. I would be very interested in obtaining it.
Thanks.
You bet.
Okay, Representative Mabry?
I guess, you know, I struggle with this a little bit, and we've talked about it privately. I think it's a good debate to have. I think it's worthwhile. But I also would make the argument that actually the state does run like a business in that we do tend to pay market price. And I would justify that by the fact that the governor does get paid less than many of the department heads, but we don't seem to have any problem attracting candidates to run for that position, and I suspect if that pay was cut, we'd still have candidates that would run for that position. I know that us legislators work for $1,280 a month. If you take that down to a 40-hour week, that amounts to $8 an hour, and I defy you to advertise a qualified dump truck driver that would work for $8 an hour. It just doesn't work. But we don't seem to have any problem attracting people that are willing to run for the legislature at those figures. By the same token, we have football coaches that make $600,000 a year, and that's market price. And chiefs of OHSU that are paid $600,000, and that's market price. So I think we do kind of run like a business in those regards. So I just really struggle with that, and I think I just kind of ran out of gas there.
Okay.
but I think it's a worthwhile conversation to have, and I commend you for bringing it forward.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Representative. I have two other people that would like to that are signed up to testify, and they did come from a distance, and so I'd like to ask them to come forward. So I'm going to excuse Representative.
Thank you.
And members, we are supposed to be on the floor at 10:30. I am going to appoint whomever stays here with me to take testimony to as a subcommittee of the committee for the purposes of taking testimony, and if there's anyone that feels like you need to leave to go to the floor, you may go ahead and do that. Representative Nelson,
may I as I still need to go to the House floor based on missing several votes due to an illness.
Mm-hmm.
But I first needed to apologize to Representative Krasinski because I did not intend to impugn his character, and I want to apologize before when I said he did not speak the truth. I meant that was not what I took as the interpretation of the bill, so I want to apologize to him, and I ask him to please straighten me out.
I appreciate that. I did want to just say that when I looked at the bill, that section, it says the state agency may not own a light-duty vehicle. Then the next sentence says a state agency that owns a light-duty vehicle shall sell the vehicle or transfer it through there. So thank you very much for your apology.
Thank you, Representative, for clarifying that. Thank you, Representative, for clarifying that. Appreciate that. Let's see. I'd like to have Richard and Mark come on up. Richard Delphine. Delphine or Delphine? Delphine and Richard Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives of the committee, my name is Mark Delphine. I'm the lobbying director for the Libertarian Party of Oregon. I will make my comments brief. We are in support of House Bill 3635 for three main points. The first point is that our opponents will contend that supply and demand is the ultimate factor in this issue. We feel that is not applicable due to the fact that it is in the public sector and that the public sector receives its funds from a captive market and does not compete in a competitive market. The second point that I'd like to make is, while the Oregon economy is struggling and lagging in the private sector, we are showing a bad example of money management by not setting limits to the public employees. Finally, the people have decided how much the governor is going to be making. The governor is considered by most people, including ourselves, to be the most responsible public position, and we feel as though there should not be any adjustment in this. And in addition to that, we don't feel as though that additional we should pay anyone else any more than the most responsible public position. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Burke. I'm the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Oregon. I, too, will be brief, and we need to run. One of the big issues here is legitimacy. I just found out, and you may know this already, that the revenue forecast shows a $650 million shortfall. I think it is highly likely that this body is going to ask for more revenue. I don't agree with it, but I think that's what's going to happen. And if that happens, legitimacy in the minds of voters is going to be important. And when you do have struggling Oregonians and you have exorbitantly paid public sector employees, at this point it almost doesn't matter whether or not it's a fair salary or not. It undermines the legitimacy of government in the minds of people who are struggling just to get by. And the more such employees which exist, the harder it's going to be to ask for revenue, even if the revenue is justified. I think that as far as hiring contracts go, talent can be farmed out. I don't expect Oregon to do anything this dramatic, but the nation of New Zealand, you probably have heard, essentially farmed out its entire Department of Transportation and now has 85 employees for the whole country, which has about the same number of road miles and weather and population base that Oregon has. And so I think that if we have this salary cap and we do need talent, which costs more in the private sector, it might be an incentive to go to the private sector. And we'd be able to save money not only in salary but in benefits and efficiencies. And this could be an incentive to promote that. Also about Minnesota. It was noted that Minnesota's rule is not statewide, it is local, but being a Minnesota native myself, I can tell you that Hennepin County and a number of the areas of Minnesota alone comprise almost the entire population of Oregon. Minneapolis is huge, St. Paul is huge, so I think that it can be regarded comparable, even though it is regarded as local as well as statewide. And I guess that's about it. And now available for any questions if you have them.
Thank you. I want to start off by saying thank you for your patience of sitting here through the other things that we needed to do as far as our agenda was concerned. Questions? Representative Mabry.
Couple, probably, if I may. Would you include the salary cap to include, like, the Oregon State and the University of Oregon football coaches?
Mr. Chair, I would not expect the witnesses to know the intent of my bill if they want to extend their opinion. I would just like to note for the record that it's not necessarily the opinion of the author of the bill, because we have never had conversation regarding it.
My understanding that it is a contractual relationship. I don't know if that's correct, but from my understanding of the legislation, persons already under contract would not be covered by this bill. And I believe, I may be in error, but that's the relationship that we have with the coach of Oregon State University.
Yeah, and my questions, if I may, Mr. Chair, are trying to get a feel for my understanding and your understanding of how that would work, because I look at other departments, maybe Fish and Wildlife, most of their funding comes from the sale of fishing license. They don't come from taxes as such. Mm-hmm. They come from fishing license, but yet they're Oregon employees. The argument has been made that the football coach's salary comes from ticket sales, so they're not part of Oregon, but I would suggest that's a resource. Just like any other fee or ticket sales or anything else, they're a resource of the state, and therefore... You know, what ramifications that might have for football coach or the OSU, OHSU
president or you know, any of those. So I'm just asking, you know, how do you see that fitting into the overall scheme of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I can only opine as to how it would be seen. But in my opinion, most people who are more than, who are even casually familiar with state government, will take a look at a football coach of a major university and understand, or at least believe, that that is a revenue-generating function. And while the Department of Fish and Wildlife and other such agencies do subsidize their expense with user fees, which is something we applaud, such agencies are not revenue-generating. They are revenue-consuming agencies. And I think that that might even be a guideline if the scope of the bill were expanded. But I think that, in my opinion, most people understand the difference between the two functions and will act in a way that reflects their understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Kiss, did you have a question?
I don't have a question. I'll save it for just the overall closing and discussion of the bill.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate your patience and time. Cindy, you're not signed up, but would you like to come up and opine on behalf of DAS, or would you like to just pass on this one?
So
she will pass. Members, I appreciate you staying here. I do have a question, Representative Kitts, for you. When you were, as you were putting this together and as we were looking at the, as it's considering the governor's salary, and I think this is an important distinction, but are you distinguishing between the cost of the governor versus the salary of the governor? What I mean by that, the governor also has other costs that are associated that the state picks up that are are a cost to us that probably, as we're looking at the total compensation package for the governor, should be taken into consideration. One would be the cost of the governor's residence. While I know that the actual purchase was done through donations and fundraising and that sort of thing, the actual maintenance is taken care of by facility services. The governor does have a vehicle, and so we have costs associated there. The governor also, of course, has the benefit package in addition, so the PERS retirement plan, the insurance plan, and that sort of thing. And then there are also costs associated with security. And by the way, I'm not trying to even suggest that we should not do any of these things. I think that I just want to make sure that these are taken into consideration as part of the cost and part of the overall scheme of how, you know. So if we're looking at, for example, the director of DHS in terms of salary and that sort of thing,
Mr. Chair, I think you bring up great points. My bill is related to salary specific. I would just, as a point of clarification, the governor, unlike the superintendent of the Willamette ESD, does not own his car. It was not given to him. It is a car that he uses. It's a state car. So there's a big distinction there, and I think that as part of compensation packages, and my bill is amendable to include and change that policy that would include those folks and prohibit school boards from giving away cars to superintendents that, you know, the taxpayers have paid for. It's meant to open the discussion. I realize there are certain people in our, you know, within our bureaucracy that make a very good living of six figures, but those people claim they do three jobs, and I would argue that if we had, and I don't question that, and if that's the case, so be it. Then I would encourage us to bring back House Bill 3073 that listed what jobs, what the description, and what the pay. And if people are doing three jobs, then I would ask that they be compensated for those three jobs. There's nothing in my bill that says you can't be hired for two jobs, you know, if you're doing them. I would challenge the thought process behind doing quote-unquote three jobs, because if you're putting in 40 hours a week and you were doing three jobs and doing three legitimate jobs at 40 hours a week, that would be 120 hours a week to do those three jobs. And I would question the legitimacy of anybody able to put in that type of time. If they were, I would like to get on that regiment that would enable them, because I have a hard time putting in 15 hours a day at my job and not squeezing in sleep. That being said, for the record, I would just like to note before we adjourn that no one testified against this bill, so it must be a good idea.
Your thoughts are well taken. With that, then, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3635, and I'm going to close the. I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on General Government.